It was the motto, a land without a people for a people without a land.
Yeah.
But no, there was people there, cities, villages, a whole in country, whole organizations that were there. And when Israel was created, it was created at the ruins of this country.
Today is Monday, May 14th, 2018. 70 years ago today, the State of Israel declared its independence. Of course, Israelis celebrate their Independence Day, Yom Ha'atzma'ut, by the Jewish calendar on the 5th of Iyar, which this year was in April. But the Trump administration is commemorating Israel's Independence Day today by moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. For more about the implications of this embassy move, check out our Jerusalem miniseries from December. When we aired that series, Trump had only announced his intent to move the embassy, not the timing. And the timing, it turns out, is hugely significant. Why? Because tomorrow, May 15th, is marked by Palestinians as Nakba Day. I have to confess, I'd never even heard the word Nakba until just a few years ago, and I'm probably not alone. Nakba means catastrophe in Arabic, and it's the word Palestinians use to describe their displacement in the wake of Israeli independence in 1948. No wonder most American Jews don't hear about the Nakba. The idea that the establishment of a Jewish state was a catastrophe is uncomfortable. But this year's Nakba Day will be harder to ignore. Between the embassy move and the culmination of the Great March of Return in Gaza, whatever happens today and tomorrow could have a profound impact on the future of Israel and Palestine. To understand these events, we have to listen to Palestinians and consider what the Nakba means to them. My name is Max Friedman, and this is Unsettled. On Friday afternoon, producer Alana Levinson and I sat down with Palestinian filmmaker Ahmed Mansour on his balcony in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Ahmed was born and raised in Gaza and has lived in the U.S. since 2015. He is a student in the graduate film program at New York University, and he's working on a documentary about the Arab-American community in Bay Ridge, a neighborhood in South Brooklyn. You'll hear more about his film at the end of the episode. Here's Ahmed and Alana.
I think it's really hard for a lot of people to picture what life in Gaza is like. What's it like, maybe a day in the life or a week in the life? What's it like to be a Palestinian Gazan child growing up like that?
Well, first of all, I mean, Gaza is beautiful. You know, Gaza is in the Mediterranean. It has a beautiful weather. The food is the best, definitely better than the food in the U.S., the culture, the dancing, the girls are really pretty, the guys are handsome, everyone, you know, takes care of her and himself. So it's all like really intimate, and the families are really close from each other, and like the social bond is really, really strong. And this is what the Israeli occupation and colonization could not destroy, that through their ethnic cleansing and occupying forces, they couldn't kill the social life of the people, of the Palestinians in general. So life in general is beautiful, at least for me. So what is happening to Gaza is crazy. Since I came here 3 years ago, you know, I don't think about the water when I get up in the morning and go take a shower and wash my face. I don't think that the water might not be running, or the power is out, or there is a drone that might, you know, fire a missile at you. So basically, if you are in Gaza, like, you keep thinking about the basic things that you don't think about here. Water, power, things that you don't even, you know, mention. But those things, little trivial things, are what people in Gaza think about all the time, every day, 24/7. The basic.
Because you might wake up one morning and you might not have water coming out of your sink?
Of course. Like, every morning you're not going to have water. If you're going to have water 3 days a week, that would be great, like for 4 hours. Or power, you know, 6 hours every day, you're really lucky.
So how do you conserve water? Do you save it somewhere in order to?
Oh yeah, that's a whole operation. Yeah, it's a pain in the ass. It's you've gotta have what do you call it, on the roof, like big tanks. Mm. So whenever you have power and water, you pump water there. But you know, families in Gaza are big. So we are 5 sisters and 3 brothers, and my mother and my dad. So we consume a lot of water.
Right.
So it's like this becomes your routine. Every day you really worry about the water. Otherwise, you're not going to have water.
Right. And you were saying that you also, something you think about is missiles and regular kind of threat of force. Is that something that you would see as a child?
I mean, this is like, yeah, we were talking about the normal situation there. This is like the normal situation. The drones in Gaza, they are like in every corner in the sky above you, watching you 24/7. And if you are doing anything that would upset the drones, you get one of them.
What does that mean, you get one of them?
Like a missile, like, hates you. I mean, you've got to understand that since 2006, Israel has been using Gaza as a weaponry testing field. Whatever weapons they get, they test it on Gaza, right? So when the F-35 warplanes were sold to Israel, 10 of them flew at the same time and dropped, I don't know how many tons of bombardment on Gaza. And they were like, boom, they worked. And then the U.S. sold them all over the world because they worked. They did the mission, and then this is how they market. You know, for the weapon, you've got to test it. Like if it kills more people, you know, it causes really harm to the infrastructure and all this stuff. So Gaza is this field.
Wow. That's chilling. I can't imagine that. So Gaza has been in the news a lot lately, more than I think people are used to in times that when there isn't a conflict between Hamas and Israel. Because there's been this massive uprising, and it's come right around the commemoration of the Nakba. And we've talked a little bit on our show about the Nakba, but because it's such a fraught issue, we tend to say to our listeners, we're not going to get into all of this today. Now, in this 70th year, we'd like to get into it. We'd like to hear from you. What does the Nakba mean to you? What does the Nakba mean in general? And what is the commemoration of the Nakba Day for Palestinian people?
And just to correct you, you said a conflict between Hamas and Israel. It's not. There's no conflict between Gaza Strip and with the West Bank is occupied by Israel. So there's no conflict between the occupier and the occupied. There's an assault, there's an attack, there's annihilation, there's ethnic cleansing. So for the Nakba, I mean, you said how we commemorate Nakba. Like, we don't commemorate Nakba. Nakba is, as someone was born in a refugee camp, a third generation of refugees from what's called Israel now, Nakba is part of you. It's an integral part of who you are. What happened in 48? In 48, the Jewish terrorist groups started targeting the Palestinian villages and cities. So 530 village and cities were totally destroyed. And the rest, they kept it and they changed how it looks like, and they, like, you know, Israelite, like, I don't know how, whether this is a verb, but they make it.
They Israelized it.
Yeah, they Israelized it.
I don't know if it's a word either, but
to make it like as you know, as part of the Israel 3,000 years ago. So after the expulsion and destroying the Palestinian cities and villages, there was like 800,000 Palestinians out of 1.4 million were expelled, right? So they went all over the neighboring countries. So you have now around 6 million Palestinian refugees around the world, right? And you have 58 refugee camps in the Gaza Strip and West Bank, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. So in Gaza, there are 8 refugee camps. And I'm from one of them called Maghazi refugee camp. It's in the middle area. So yeah, what happened in 48, because, you know, Israel established itself as a state on the ruins of what was, you know, ours, for Palestinian Arab, for Palestinian Jews, for Palestinian Christians. This is why 48 in May, it's like, this is the big Nakba. That's right, but Nakba never ended. It has started there with the creation of the state Israel.
I think it's there's so few moments when I've heard anyone say, when I've heard people say Palestinian Jews, because for so long, you know, the way I grew up anyway, there are Jews and there are Palestinians, or there are Israelis and Palestinians, or there are Israelis and Arabs, and they're in conflict with each other. It's interesting for me to hear you talk about Palestinian Jews in pre-state.
Yeah, this is what I grew up with, like, with my grandmother telling me about her Jewish neighbors. They were all Palestinians. They were all speaking Arabic and Hebrew and whatever, but they were all neighbors living under, you know, like in the same village, and they go to each other's feasts, and they are wearing the same, and this is what, like, you know, Palestine used to be. And the Jews never, like, they've been always in the Holy Land, and the best times for the Jewish people ever was in the Middle East.
You mentioned that your grandmother used to tell stories about living side by side with Jewish Palestinians, and then she was expelled from her village. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about which village that was, and what you've heard from your grandparents, from your parents, about the Nakba. What's the effect that the Nakba has had on your family?
So my grandparents never told us about really the actual horrible things that happened in the Nakba. Because I don't know whether they are traumatized, whether what they have seen really, really, they wanted to erase it from their memory. I personally do not know. But when we look at what happened in the Nakba through historians and through Israeli even scholars, there are like 70 massacres happened, right? So my grandparents would never talk about that. And I'm actually now, I'm a filmmaker, and my first thing to do when I go back is to really convince my grandmother, because she's the only grandmother I have from my mother's side and my father's side that's still living today. I really want to challenge myself to get her to talk, to document her story, because this generation is fading now. So that's one thing. She's from a village called Sawafir, which is like near Ashkelon. And yeah, she was old. She talks about the beautiful things, like how she was growing up and how they were like kind of agricultural village. So how they used to harvest their plants, and how they gather after work and sing and have their cup of tea, and everyone comes in, and how simple, peaceful, and welcoming environment, and everything is open. You like So this is like what she talks about. She does not talk about the horror she lived through and how she had to walk all the way to Gaza, ending up in a refugee camp.
You think he's right? protecting you from that?
I don't know. That's one thing. I don't know. I really want to challenge myself and like get to know and get everybody knows those people who've been through tragedies, like the people in the Holocaust, the survivors, right? Like what those people who are not speaking out, like why, you know? I'm just, it's fascinating to me. And like the grief of geography, you know, touches all of us.
So I want to get to this Nakba Day. What is it about this Nakba Day that's inspired the marches in Gaza and all this activism?
I mean, because it's like 70th, it's like, you know, seven decades. Mm-hmm. And the memory of the Nakba and what happened in the Nakba is still not addressed. And what is happening now, it's not stopping. So that's why people are really, really, you know, wanted to do something and show the world that, you know, our cause is still alive. Mm-hmm. And I think the main shaker of the Great March of Return in Gaza is the President Trump's decision of moving the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. I was actually quite happy when Trump did that.
Oh, yeah?
I really did. I was really happy because the U.S. policies were all the time the same policies that Trump now announcing, if not worse. Mm-hmm. So when he announced that, I was like, oh, finally, now we know the U.S. foreign policy when it comes to Israel and Palestine. Ah, everyone now, you see?
Now all the cards are on the table.
That's it. Mm-hmm. Not like with soft power, you know, smile in your face and fuck you from under the table as they used to do all the time. So when Trump announced the U.S. embassy decision to move it from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, for me was for the advantage of the Palestinians. Because the U.S. showed us what they really stand for. Was clear, without any vagueness, without any shadow. This is who we are, the United States of America, and our stances on this conflict. Since the 80s, we see the U.S. as this player, main player of trying to get both parties together, which was totally false. Now we know that it was false. Now we know what their really, really, their agenda is. So by Trump's decision, like the happy part of me is that the United States was not and is not and will never be a broker at any peace talks between the Palestinians and the Israelis, period. Mm-hmm. The European come in, whatever, but the U.S. cannot be a broker. When President Trump announced the decision, and he said then, and we're now starting with the deal of the century through Kushner to bring peace. Mm. I was like, wait a second. What is happening? It's like we're fighting over a piece of cake. And then, you know, someone comes and says, okay, I'm gonna solve this problem for you. You, Lana, take the piece of cake, and now let's while you're fighting, let's bring, you know, you together.
Yeah.
Will you give her the piece of cake, and this is what we're fighting for? So this is what he literally said.
Yeah. So we're here, we're talking to you on Friday before the Tuesday, it's the commemoration of the Nakba Day. What do you see happening? Have you heard from friends or family, what's going to happen? And also, what is it like for you to be here in this moment and not to be there?
I mean, it's hard to not be there and just, you know, be in a country that's part of the problem of the suffering of my family and my people. And moving the embassy at the time where the Palestinians were expelled of their homes, where the Palestinians were ethnically cleansed from their villages and cities, it's the most inhumane and insulting thing that you can ever imagine. Over 50 people who were killed in the marches protesting Trump's decision, and many Americans would have no clue about that, but the blood of 50 Palestinians who were killed protesting the U.S. president's decision is at the hands of America and the Americans. This is how I see it.
Well, Ahmed, we're so appreciative of your coming on Unsettled. I think it's, speaking personally, when I grew up, I heard that the Nakba was something that Palestinian people said, that the Jewish people's success in creating a state was Palestinian people's catastrophe, and it was simplified, just boiled down to that. I think hearing your story, you know, is really important.
It was the motto, a land without a people for a people without a land.
Yeah.
But no, there was people there, cities, villages, whole in country, whole organizations that were there. And when Israel was created, it was created at the ruins of this country. And it did not end there. What happened, like the ethnic cleansing that happened in 48 in the Nakba and the catastrophe, is the same thing that's happening now of the land confiscation in the West Bank to the illegal settlements in Gaza and the border. And each year they took more lands and make it tighter and tighter in the Gazans. The theft of water, the hundreds of thousands of Palestinian prisoners, the three wars against Gaza for the last 10 years, over 3,000 people were killed, and I lost so many friends. And now, as a journalist and filmmaker, my friends in Gaza are now being shot and injured for the last 4 weeks. So for me, this is my Nakba. I didn't see the Nakba in 48. My grandmother saw it, and she never will speak about it. But now this is what I'm seeing, and this is what I've been through. Today, my Nakba is happening in full force. I've been here for 3 years, and on Tuesday, in 3 days, I'm wearing my robe. I'm graduating from one of the best film schools in the world, and everyone will have their families with them except me, because my family is imprisoned in Gaza. They cannot come and share and celebrate with their son here. So is that justice? Is that like, you know, who wants to not be with their kids when they graduate or when they get married or when they are in pain or when they are happy?
You're graduating on Nakba Day.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm graduating on Nakba Day. So I don't know whether I'm gonna be celebrating or weeping. I'm debating. I got my robe today, but the Nakba is happening all the day. So I, like every day I have a new Nakba. So my Nakba for this week is at the time of the real Nakba in 1948, but also me graduating, working so hard for the last 2 years to gain this, my master's degree in films and journalism, and my family won't be with me. So this is my personal Nakba. For the last 3 weeks, my Nakba was losing my best of friends covering the march with their press mark vest. So every week, every day, I have like personal Nakba, and this is the case with every Palestinian. Mm-hmm. With every Palestinian around the world, they have their own Nakba. Our families are scattered around the world, and because we are refugees, it's hard for any country to grant us any visa. So I really hate talking about the tragic life that we live, because we're proud, because we're resilient, and we keep fighting against all odds, and we never ever give up. But it is hard. It is unbelievable. Next week is the Nakba commemoration and the moving of the U.S. embassy, which makes it double Nakba and double catastrophe. but that shouldn't be just one commemoration and everyone talks about it. People need to talk about it all the time until it ends. And what's happening there in the Holy Land, it's unacceptable and it's illegal and it's immoral, and everyone needs to hear about that. We shouldn't be just selective on issues of justice, you know? It does not need like Jews or Arabs or Palestinians to talk about the Palestinian struggle. It needs to be everyone's moral compass around this issue until it ends, until it brings justice to the people who've been suffering for so long.
Inshallah.
Inshallah. And this is the name of my film, Brooklyn Inshallah.
Oh, really? Oh, can we say that? Brooklyn Inshallah.
Yeah, it's...
Ahmed's film, Brooklyn Inshallah, follows the 2017 campaign of Khader El-Yateem, a Palestinian-American Lutheran pastor who became the first Arab-American to run for New York City Council. Ahmed and his team are raising money to finish post-production. You can find a trailer for the film and a link to the fundraising campaign at our website, unsettledpod.com. Unsettled is produced by Emily Bell, Asaf Calderon, Yoshi Fields, Max Friedman, and Alana Levinson. This episode was produced by Max Friedman and Alana Levinson and edited by Max Friedman. Our theme music is by Nat Rosenzweig. Don't forget to follow us on social media. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And most importantly, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode of Unsettled.